Let me tell you about the new sports app we've launched as a part of our USA Today family. USA Today Sports Plus is the new sports app that puts the fans first. Get the latest scores, stats, and standings and enjoy interactive experiences with our award-winning sports writers. Download the USA Today Sports Plus app from the Apple or Google Play stores today. USA Today Sports Plus. Fan harder.
Hello and welcome to the Colts Cover 2 podcast. I am Joel A. Erickson. I'm joined as always by Nate Atkins. And Nate has done the legwork here for us for this podcast. We're going to go through some of the mailback questions that Nate wasn't able to get to in the piece that he's got in his mailbag. He's got on Indy Star. Nate, you've been doing the mailbags for a little while now. What do you think? Why do you like doing those? What do you think is the best thing about them?
I think the main thing is that sometimes there's just questions that you and I may have, we may gloss over. We may touch on it's random points and stories, but we don't really ever flesh out and explain for people some things that we also just don't get to that, because there's just so many different areas we're trying to cover here. So, there's questions that come in each time I do these. Some of them are what you'd expect, the big picture stuff about, right this time of year, a lot of people want to know, what free agent wide receiver they might sign or, who they may have taken at 42 if they stay there in the draft. But there's always some questions that are just off your radar about assistants they've hired. And sometimes it's stuff that I'm like, I don't know the answer to that yet, but I'm going to ask it the next time that we get Frank Reich or Chris Ballard. So it's always kind of informed my just questions with those guys and understanding of the team. And it puts us in a place where we can, I think, serve people better, because sometimes you can go get them an answer when we don't really know the answer to it yet. But also sometimes it just presents hypotheticals that, I wouldn't, it'd be kind of weird for me to just go out and write a story on every hypothetical out there. But when you get asked a direct question, you can just answer it that way. It's just an easier way to wade into it. Which is, how I've been able to write about, situations like Tyrann Mathieu and James Bradbury, things where it's like we don't really quite know what's there. But, once someone asks, we can kind of wade through the details and the possibilities. And it just kind of informs your thinking on the team. And obviously, then the other part of it is just it's fun to involve people in this. I know right before I took over, you were doing this podcast with different fans each week and longtime listeners. And I think that's cool. And it's, it's what we do at the Indy Star, just trying to keep people involved. And, that's the business. Get them to subscribe, get them to feel like they are a part of this, and they very much are. So it's always been fun for me.
Yeah. My version of this is to do Ask Joel at the halftime of games, which I actually borrowed from my former coworker, Ross Dellinger, who now works at Sports Illustrated. That's kind of when I try to do it. We're going to jump right into the questions here. We're going to start with at Suck It Elon, which I don't know if Elon Musk listens to this podcast.
I debated whether to include the name on that one. Then I'm like, of all victims, I think that one will be okay.
He says, how exactly will Gus Bradley's defensive scheme differ from Eberflus's? Whose roles will change the most, and who will have the biggest opportunity to spotlight their talents? I actually really like this question, because I've been gathering stuff to write a longer story on the changes in the defense for a couple months now. So I can speak to this quite a bit, because I'm actually kind of at the point of writing it. I've just had a bunch of other stuff coming out lately that I haven't had a chance to slot it in. I think, number one, for as much as Matt Eberflus talked and said that, the defensive line and his scheme was supposed to just get up the field and attack the quarterback, there was a lot of read in that. There was a lot of read and react at times. There was a heavy emphasis on the run game at times. I think you saw that in the way personnel was used, how many snaps guys got, what players were on the field. From everything they've said, they're not playing that sort of read and react at all. Nate Ali, the new defensive line coach, was hired because he's experienced in the attack front that Robert Saleh uses. He described it as you are attacking a gap and getting and going after the quarterback, and you mess up anything in front of you on the way there. So I think one spot that immediately could benefit is just the defensive ends. Defensive ends pinning their ears back and going after the quarterback at every play is one of the spots that I think is a big thing, because clearly that position in the last defense was asked to read and react a lot. I think that that helps. I know DeForest Buckner really loves playing in this defense. Really loves it. He's been texting Nate Ollie basically since Ollie got hired about how excited he is to be back in. He played in San Francisco with Sala.
Yeah, what's crazy about DeForest Buckner is that in Eberflus's scheme, that position is the most important. They will tell you that. I covered the Bears before I got here, and that's the same approach they drafted for under Lovie Smith, which is how Chris Ballard kind of came up. They have to have a three technique. So that's why this year Eberflus went out and or the Bears did, and they had signed a defensive tackle for tons of money. Kind of forget his name at the moment, but all of a sudden, like, that doesn't fit in this defense, or it doesn't. The reason it's important is that position just absorbs double teams, which of course is not what DeForest is most going to want to do, and what's not going to use the full complement of his abilities. So he's definitely going to take a big step up, you know, just in terms of being a playmaker. I think sometimes it feels like he disappears a little, and it's only because he was double teamed more than every defensive lineman last year other than Aaron Donald, which of course Aaron Donald's always going to top those lists. So that tells you a lot about how much they put on his plate. And now in this read and react, or in this attacking front rather than read and react, he has a chance to really get back to some of the dominant play we saw his first year here, saw at the end of his time in San Francisco in the Super Bowl. So definitely the defensive lines where it changes the most. But I think it's also interesting what they do in the secondary, because of course this all started with the Legion of Boom in Seattle, where that's kind of the part of the, I think, the defense that people remember the most. Richard Sherman at cornerback and Cam Chancellor and Earl Thomas at safety. And so the big differences are from Eberflus's approach is they're going to play a lot of bump and run. That was a big, big thing for them. That's why they normally go for cornerbacks with length. And if they don't have length, then, you know, recovery speed is a big part of that. So Stephon Gilmore's got, you know, he's not Richard Sherman length, but he's certainly very physical and can fit that well. That'll be interesting to see. That's Brandon Faison on the other side's got length. That's why he fits that. He might start. It might be Isaiah Rogers, who's more the you know, recovery speed guy, but you're going to see much more aggressive approaches at the line of scrimmage. And then the other thing is the safeties are going to be split. So, and Eberflus did that somewhat, but almost all the time in normal settings for Gus Bradley, you're going to see, you know, one safety up top in the middle third, which I assume is going to be Julian Blackman when he's healthy, and probably Rodney McLeod until then, and then one in the box. And right now that's going to be Kari Willis, and we'll see when Nick Cross kind of works his way in. But you'll just see the safeties really have a different, two very different responsibilities in this defense rather than just being two guys on the back end.
Yeah, I think they talked a lot in the last defense about how the safeties were somewhat interchangeable and they would try to do different things with the safeties in Gus Bradley's defense have pretty much always been had pretty defined roles. And I think one of the other things is, like, everyone's going to center in on, like, cover three match, that kind of thing, versus cover two. To some degree, I think what they did at the end of last year, they were headed that way anyway with Eberflus. I don't know what he's going to do in Chicago without Frank Reich and Chris Ballard there to kind of, I think, gently nudge him in that direction. I don't know if they go back to more cover two with Eberflus, but that's not going to be quite as big of a departure as it would have been, say, if this had happened in 2018 or 2019. They played a lot of cover three match, but you're right. The press coverage, Bradley said it, I think, the last time we talked to him, that they press. That's an important part. Even in zone, they're going to press and bump. And so I think that matters. And then one of the things, a lot of times that match part, that changes how it works for the linebackers too. There was a lot of landmark coverage in Eberflus's defense at times, I felt like. And, you know, Ron Miles was telling me a while back that a lot of times their match defenders are their hook defenders. Well, hook is often a linebacker. So Okereke, Leonard, you're going to be they're going to have match responsibilities. Kenny Moore is another hook defender because of where he lines up, the safeties. So that's kind of a big rundown. That's kind of a preview of a story that I'll do maybe next week. But yeah, we've been trying to dig into that over a couple of different times. One of the funny things about right now is that we only get players and coaches once a week. So if you're trying to work on something longer, you kind of have to sort of build on it because you can't get everybody you need at one time.
Yep, no doubt.
The next question from Chuck DeBlue. Hypothetical, Colts can add any one player in the NFL free of charge, no cap considerations, no trade compensation. Who do they add that would help them the most? Could be an upgrade at a position, could fill a current hole. What player helps their Super Bowl chances the most? Nate, I have my answer in my head, but I'm going to let you go first.
The one amendment I'd like to make to this is non-quarterback.
Oh, well, that's fine. I was going to say you immediately add Patrick Mahomes.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think that's just too easy. It's like if every team would have that answer, you know. So I'd like to amend it just to make it a little bit more specific to this team, especially everything we talk about is in the version of Matt Ryan. So I think it just kind of, it's too much to me to do quarterback unless you really, really want to.
Okay, fine.
That one was easy to me too. But like, I actually think there are a couple different arguments you can make if you go away from quarterback. So I have mine in my head and I want to see.
Okay, Matt, who do you got?
I've got Cooper Kupp. So when you look at this team and where the biggest hole is, you know, they went and addressed in the draft. They got a receiver, they got a potential left tackle. They've, you know, in free agency, they've signed Stephon Gilmore. They added an edge rusher in Yannick Ngakoue. They don't have anything at slot receiver. And if you listen to how they're talking right now, they see Michael Pittman Jr. and Alec Pierce, you know, Fai Talabala, which is a nickname I've learned that fans do not really like, which means I'll probably use it even more. They want them on the outsides because they're 6'3 and 6'4, and Alec Pierce has not worked in the inside, and that's not where his game is. So they've kind of left it wide open in the slot, and I think there's different guys like Nyheim Hines, you know, and some of their other tight ends who can work there and get it done, and maybe sign T.Y. Hilton. The best thing you could possibly do, I think, if you had this, this hypothetical out there, is trade for Cooper Kupp and put in the NFL's leading wide receiver in the slot, who not only is he going to be, you know, obviously super productive, but he worked, you know, he worked directly with Matthew Stafford, who is, you know, one of Matt Ryan's best friends. It would just be a seamless transition. Not only that, but he is perfect for this type of offense that does a lot of play action, that does a lot of that runs the ball as much as it does. Like, that's why Cooper Kupp became who he was in the slot, was how much he's able to add to the blocking and just really sell his routes from run looks to play action. So I think it would be, you know, I think that would take this offense to a level where it's as good as the defense, which I think could be top five.
Okay, I'm going to put a caveat in here. I've got a couple of different spots kind of bouncing around my head. So I'm going to put a caveat in here. I'm going to give you a couple. I think it depends on who you decide, who you say is the best. Maybe Laramie Tunsil because of the injuries to David Bakhtiari lately. But if you're going to give me the best left tackle, so you don't have to worry about Ryman's development. You don't have to worry about whether or not Pryor can play it. Like, you just leave that guy out there and do whatever you want with the rest of the offensive line. Is one. And then the other sneaky one I was going to add was George Kittle. But the caveat is a 15-16 game George Kittle. because I think I know that I know the Colts like Mo Alie-Cox, but if you can give me like the epitome of the Y tight end at this point in the NFL, and then you also have Jelani Woods developing behind him, I think this is a terrifying tight end group. And Frank Reich really knows how to use that and can use it well. Kittle can do all of the blocking that they would need to do. And obviously he's an enormous weapon in the passing game. So, yeah, I think I might go Kittle.
Yeah. Well, that's what's kind of interesting at the tight end spot. I thought about that, but it's Kittle's got the injury concerns. Travis Kelce does not have that, but he's not nearly the blocker that Kittle is. And I do think for this offense, that's a huge, huge part of that position. Otherwise, like Kelsey's
kind of a slot receiver. Let's be honest. Yeah, he's like a big slot receiver.
And that's why I thought about Kyle Pitts too, because it's like, why not just give Matt Ryan Kyle Pitts and let him go into year two? But again, same deal. He's more of a, you know, souped up slot receiver type. But you know, if I was going to go with a guy as a slot Kyle receiver, Pitts, I'm going to go with Cooper Kupp. What's that?
If you're letting me take Kyle Pitts, Nate, I might take Kyle Pitts just for the heck of it.
I was going to say, I was surprised you went with tight end that's not Kyle Pitts. What's interesting, though, is you brought up left tackle, and I definitely, that was the one I would have gone to if not for Cooper Kupp. But I don't think I would have gone with the guys you mentioned, even though they're obviously great players. I think I give them Trent Williams. He doesn't have as long left in the tank. Injury
concerns was my issue with him, too. Him and Bakhtiari are both, like, the injury guys.
And Trent Williams. Or and Teron Armstead. Right. But, yeah, Trent, as far as, like, the guy in the field, though, Trent Williams, not only just a lockdown veteran left tackle, but just how dominant he is in the run game.
He's very mean
in the run game. I think that could replace some of what you lost in Jack Doyle. It'd be pretty brilliant. I'll say the one other player I considered.
Him and Quentin next to each other is, like, a defense's absolute worst nightmare. You would not,
John Taylor.
You would not come out of that game feeling very well at all. As long as Williams is healthy, you're just getting blown to the ground every other running play.
Yeah, yeah. Now that Trent Williams is very close to Cooper Kupp for me. I guess I just went with something that I thought would give them a little bit more of a ceiling in the passing game, but. It's a fun exercise. I will say the one sneaky player I thought of was Justin Tucker, because I still don't know who kicks for this team. Okay. And just, you know, one more weapon to add to the offense that just kind of expands the entire scoring range for them could be a lot of fun.
Wow. Kicker. Man, yeah. That's the one we didn't see coming. So there's some good ones there. Next one from Noah N. What do you make of the Colts UDFA haul? Any particular that you think could challenge for a 53-man roster spot? I think the size of the UDFA haul, we're going to find out officially who's on and who's off. By my trying to confirm everybody, because sometimes when colleges put stuff out, it makes it look like they're a UDFA, but they're not. They're actually a mini camp tryout. But it sounds like they've got 20, and I think that the Colts are counting on this UDFA group a little bit, just because Ballard said at the combine that they had like 700 more players that they had to scout this year than last year because of all the COVID stuff. And so I think that depth made them interested in thinking that there's a chance to find some players in that. There's several spots that I think somebody could make the 53-man roster. I think the obvious one, as much as they like Deion Jackson, is number three running back. They got C.J. Verdell, Devontae Price, Max Borgi. Like, they signed three running backs there, gave some of them some guaranteed money. And I think that those guys that's kind of an all-out competition for that number three running back position. I don't know how much you play on the 53-man roster, but you have to have that guy.
Yeah, I definitely think that's the most likely spot. I can't really separate those guys until we see them. And, of course, I won't be at rookie minicamp, so that'll be all Joel reporting on them. But I definitely think that's the spot because, you know, number three running backs just kind of been in flux the past couple of years. Obviously, they went from Marlon Mack to Deion Jackson, which is more of a special teams move. But there's always young guys coming in the league who can do some of that. It's going to be interesting to see if C.J. Verdell, where he is just physically, because he's
Verdell is the interesting one to me, just because he did rush for 1,000 yards twice at Oregon before he started getting hurt.
Yeah, I think we don't know how healthy he is now either.
Right.
So that to me is kind of the bigger question. I think, you know, just if I just look at these names and think who do I think can be the best long-term player, it's Verdell. I just don't know where he is right now. If they feel like he's ready enough. The other position I think that we will see, we could very well see a UDFA make it as linebacker, because they just didn't go and add any in the draft. And I know they got their top four set, but you know, that's a position that just matters so much to Gus Bradley and the way they build out this defense. Every guy I talked to who has you know, seeing Gus Bradley's rise, talks about how he's always looking for the next linebacker. So a couple of these guys like JoJo Doman out of Nebraska, and then Sterling Weatherford, he's converting the linebacker, right, from safety?
I think so.
That's the deal. We got to learn a lot more about these guys. They've just kind of flown in. But I will say that's the transition that Cato June once made into the NFL. So he's now the assistant linebackers coach. So I wouldn't be surprised at all to see him kind of see that guy. And then the one obvious answer here that is kind of different is Marcel Dabo, you know, who you just wrote about on this week. And again, it's kind of hard to compare him to this because he's going to probably be on the practice squad on that free position. So I guess he won't actually technically be on the roster, but to me kind of is, like, that's only a technicality to move him there and have him there for free until they decide to promote him. But I just get the feeling that they see a lot in that guy, special teams to start. And then it's interesting, they want to start him at safety rather than corner. His athletic profile is more of a corner, except for the fact that he doesn't change direction very well. So maybe they just want to play him more in that deep third role where he's all working downhill and just all that speed is coming out all the time. It'll be kind of interesting to see how he looks on the practice field, but he'll be around on this roster in some capacity.
Jason Sanders, a longtime podcast listener, asked, does a more legitimate passing game open things up further for the run game, allowing Taylor to match or surpass his yardage from last season? Or do the Colts lean more on the passing game and his rushing yards go down? This is a good question. It's kind of a question that, like, the fantasy players are going to want to know. Although if you're not drafting Jonathan Taylor high, you're a bad fantasy player.
About the easiest advice you can give somebody.
I do think that his rushing yards might go down a little bit and his carries might go down a little bit because they can throw the ball again. But I don't think that that's a bad thing for the Colts offense in general, because if you remember down the stretch there, the last four or five games, there were a lot of times that, I mean, he got his 100 yards, but it was a real slog because of how much teams were stacking the box. And I also think it's probably good to keep some carries off of him, get him down from the 330 range into the 270-ish range. He can still be very effective if you do that. I just keep thinking, if you have a player like Taylor, who I think is one of the very few running backs in the league who takes your running game to a different level, he's that special, you want to keep him like that as long as possible. And I think it's been proven that the more care, if you start getting them up around, he didn't quite hit the threshold in touches last year, but a few more and he's in the danger range. So if you could pull a couple off of him, I think that's good. I think his receiving numbers are going up.
Yeah, I think that's kind of where I see it, is that his rushing kind of has to go down, I think, just because they're not, unless things go poorly here with Matt Ryan, they're not planning to run him this way. They were not planning on that last season. So in the first 10 games of the year, he averaged 16 carries a game. In the final seven games, he averaged 24 carries a game. Like, that is a massive jump. That's a 50% jump. And that was right around the time when the passing game was falling apart. They didn't trust Carson Wentz. They didn't trust the concepts. He wasn't throwing the concepts. We've been through all of that. That is not how this is supposed to go. And I don't think it's at all likely, unless Matt Ryan gets hurt, which he's only missed one game in 12 years, for that to happen, because Matt Ryan is not a guy who changes his style of play, even if there's, you know, a couple bad games or some bad moments. So, and it's also for the reason you said, is that it's like diminishing returns. If there's a position that happens to, it's absolutely running back. And so there's an incentive to save him carries, even if, you know, it would still be perfectly effective to run him. It just makes sense to take some off his plate. And yeah, give him some situations that are just a little less bruising, like get him out, in some screens and some other receptions out of the backfield. So it's hard to see normally I would say his efficiency would go up in this kind of situation, but I mean, he also led the NFL in yards per carry for running backs.
I know.
At 5.5.
I know.
And like had the most, all the advanced stats about yards created, all that were on his side. It's like he and Nick Chubb are just so far out in front of everyone else. So I just assume he's going to lead that again. I don't know that that number will, it can't go up that much more. But overall, I think we're going to look at his numbers at the end of the year and be like, you know what? He may not have had 1,800 yards and 18 touchdowns, but this was just as good of a year, if not better of a year, when you add in the receiving and just kind of what it played out and how it affected the team.
Johan Sue asks, who is the most overrated Colts player and who is the most underrated? I will confess, I'll throw this to you first so I can think on it a little bit. I will confess to sort of hating the overrated, underrated thing, because I feel like it's like the most first takey we can get as a sports reporter.
It is. And I want to be careful with it. It's something I kind of waded into yesterday, and it's, I don't think Twitter is, you know, the best place for it in hindsight. It's more of these things where, like, what I want to talk about, I think it's easier to talk about who's underrated. With overrated, it's like we don't want to sit here and like put players down or like take away from what they are necessarily, and yeah, and get first takey. To me, it's more about kind of, especially someone new to this beat, just kind of seeing how like fans perceive players in their roles and their importance to the team and like what their place is on the team versus what it actually feels and looks like in the building and talking to people. So that to me is more where I want to go rather than saying like, this guy is not good, this guy is a lot better. So I'll start with my answers then. And I we'll see where you think on this. For the most, they're very tied here. So for the most overrated, I'm going with Alec Pierce. And it's simply because it's a rookie who hasn't played yet, second round pick. I that's an easy answer all the time. You go with the rookie because rookies, their expectations are always, I think, too high. Occasionally, of course, there's been guys taken high in the draft, Jamar Chase and Justin Jefferson, who've had incredible seasons. And I think it's inflated our expectation for what that position normally does. But a lot of wide receivers come from offenses where they're not built to do that. They weren't playing with Joe Burrow at LSU in the college football playoff. And so I think Alec Pierce is a good training for what the Colts will ask him to do, which is run the Z spot, run a lot of sideline routes, nine routes, just kind of be that contested catch guy along the sidelines and help expand the safeties. I think he'll have an important role in that way. I don't think his production will be that high because I do think that's a very simple role for him. And they're going to run the ball plenty. They're going to get the ball to Michael Pittman Jr. and to Nyheim Hines. I don't think at the end of the year we'll look back and he'll have this tremendous rookie year. I think it'll look more like Michael Pittman's rookie year, which I think is some people were not thrilled with, but it's totally fine. Most rookie wide receivers do that. And that's where I think he is. And so then my most underrated is Michael Pittman Jr. because I think, you know, I just hear all the time fans talk about, you know, we have this depth. I've heard him called a depth piece, which is absurd to me. I've heard people, you know, they just talk about him as he's a decent possession guy to have as maybe your number two. And I think they're just way selling short a guy who physically has measurables that receivers just don't have. You just don't find 6'4 receivers with his ability to catch the ball, go up vertically, and then what he does with it in his hands. And I just don't think we saw it last year enough in the offense with Carson Wentz, where that fit for a while at the jump balls, but he wasn't getting the yak opportunities, the ball in the middle of the field, like he did at times with Phillip Rivers, like in the playoff game against Buffalo. And so my, you know, semi-bold prediction this year, I think he's going to go for 1,400 yards with Matt Ryan, because I think Matt Ryan is the quarterback for Michael Pittman Jr. When you look back at what he did with Julio Jones and how they were just killed teams in the middle of the field, I think they'll work on that. Maybe it takes a little bit of time. Maybe I'm being aggressive there, but I think he's going to show people that he's much more than just some number two contested catch guy, but he's a full-rounded number one receiver.
I'm going to agree with you. And I think the whole discussion about whether or not somebody is a possession receiver who, if they're a high volume catch and yards guy, is maybe one of the dumbest arguments that people have. I ran into it with Michael Thomas in New Orleans a lot. You know, people like, he just catches slants. I mean, like, first downs are much, much more on a play-to-play basis, That's the kind of stuff that makes offenses efficient. That's the kind of stuff that makes offenses good on third down. And in terms of overall production, like, here's a stat for people who don't like Michael Pittman. He had more yards last season than A.J. Brown has had in any season in the NFL so far for the Tennessee Titans. Any season in the NFL so far. And I would say that the Titans stick to the throwing it more than the Colts did last year when with Carson Wentz towards the end of it. I don't fully understand sometimes the whole I understand that you want somebody who can get deep and get down the field. But I've watched a lot of games with like guys like Devontae Adams or Keenan Allen, Michael Thomas, where they have 9 catches for 97 yards, and it was all really important catches. Because it keeps drives moving, it keeps stuff going, and then you get points. I don't fully understand it. I also think that the idea that he can't be a player down the field ignores the first half of last season when he was a jump ball. He was basically the only thing that there was getting down the field on those jump balls. You can win down the field in different ways than just running past people. I actually think sometimes that the speed receiver is overrated because their actual production is 4 deep balls a season. And as much as they stretch out the defense, there's a lot of times that there's missed opportunities with quarterbacks forcing it to him. So I'll go with you on that with Pittman. I don't like the overrated question. It's tough.
Yeah. Well, okay. I'll throw out some of the other things I thought about here, and we'll see if there's one that stands out to you. Again, I'm not trying to say any of these players aren't good. It's just more about, like, I think the fan perception of what their role or their production is may be off. One other I considered here, and I hate to say it because I love this player, is Nyheim Hines. And I only say that because at least once a week I get an email or a tweet from someone asking why they haven't moved him to slot receiver, what they don't see in him. He could be this great slot receiver. I've seen people say he could be Deebo Samuel. I just think it kind of gets taken too far. You know, he is a very effective player in exactly how they've used him when the quarterback's thrown the ball, which is when he had Phillip Rivers and Andrew Luck and is catching, you know, 63 passes a season. He's a guy who, you know, he makes plays out of the backfield. He's a great check down. He's, you know, you can scheme up some motion for him to throw him out of the backfield. But it's always like those players are completely different than NFL slot receivers. And I learned this lesson once when I was a young reporter in this field. And I'm trying to remember, the Lions were playing the Cardinals. And David Johnson at that time was leading all running backs and receiving yards. And I asked Glover Quinn, like, could this guy be an NFL receiver? Could they just move him there if they had another running back? He said, no. I said, really? He's got, you know, more yards than all these guys. He said, yeah, that's because they motion him from the backfield out and they get him lined up on linebackers who are not used to coverage. And like, it's completely different to then line that player up at in the slot against nickel corners and safeties and have him play that role, snap in and snap out. So I just think that it's more just that the ideas of what Hines can be have taken it too far to where people don't, you know, sit back and realize they've got a very good player here. He's a very good player for this role, and they need to go find a slot receiver rather than make him something that, you know, that running backs just aren't meant to be.
Yeah. So the hardest part with overrated is that I feel like when you start talking about overrated, we get into a thing where you have to be careful, and I'm not saying you're doing this. I'm trying to explain to the listeners why I'm reluctant. Is like, people take everything nowadays as player is good or bad, or to the more extreme, like you're either saying a player is the best player who's ever played NFL football or completely awful and worthless. And that's not what we're trying to say here. I would also say that sometimes I think Hines' explosiveness has not necessarily matched his perception. His longest play in the NFL is 36 yards on a catch. He's got a 31-yard run, a 34-yard run, but those don't happen as often as maybe it seems like they, even with Rivers and even with Luck, they didn't. Those types of plays didn't happen. So even when those plays, like even when he had the right quarterback for it, that's not to say I don't think Nyheim's Hines is important and plays a big role in the offense. I just, his production in terms of explosive plays doesn't match the perception. Taylor has been a far more explosive player, both as a runner and to some degree as a receiver, than Hines has in terms of the actual yardage gained. Again, I just want to say this again, because I know how things are taken. Like, I'm not saying that they shouldn't have him or he's bad or anything like that. Well, I'm actually, just saying, like, what
if anyone talks of Nyheim Hines, it's like our podcast is absolutely at the front of the line. Like,
he's reported
offseason of that's why they wanted to move on from Carson Wentz. One of, you know, tons of reasons, but one of them was that they have this very effective option that in the second half of the year they never used. But again, it's for what he is, which is that, you know, that kind of more of a gadget receiver out of the backfield rather than, like you said, some guy that's going to go vertically down the field. I mean, he's still 5'9 and sub 200. So it's just, that's all. Yeah, I just wanted to have this conversation on the podcast because, like you said, it gets spun and taken as like good or bad. Whereas, like, this is a nuanced conversation to me where we very much think highly of Nyheim Hines, just not in the way that I think fans do, which is kind of how it plays out. It's easier to talk about underrated because I think that's where some, you know,
One other guy
I'd put out there for underrated. I was just gonna say one other guy I throw out there for underrated is Matt Ryan because I think people have come around on him and there's been some excitement, but I still think people talk about him as like what Phillip Rivers was when he came in at age 39. And Phillip did a very nice job, so that's not even a bad thing. But I still think there's more in there. I don't think people have watched enough of him in Atlanta to realize why that team wasn't winning the past few years. It's not because of Matt Ryan. It's because pretty much everything else there fell apart. Receivers disappeared. Running back and run games were in the bottom five of the NFL. And I just don't think he's changed very much from the guy who's been a four-time Pro Bowler, a league MVP, again, if he's in the right setting. And everything else to me is about, do they get that setting for him?
I also think that one of the guys who takes a lot of flack who probably shouldn't is Quentin Nelson. And it has to do with his positional value. I understand that Chris Reed played well in Nelson's spot last year. I don't think that would have happened over the full season. And my evidence for that is that the Colts kind of tried to let him take the right guard job from Mark Glowinski and he didn't do it. Once he got more snaps. Again, I like Chris Reed. I thought Chris Reed was a very, very good signing, maybe the best for pound for dollar signing that they had last year. But to just say that you can just plug anybody in there and they're going to play at Nelson's level is mistaken. And I think the other thing that happens here is that people talk about guards as if they don't block pass rushers ever. I don't understand that. I don't get it. I really don't get it. And I've said this on the podcast before, but I'm not basing this based on the Colts. I'm basing this based on what I learned when I covered New Orleans. And you can look at Drew Brees' yardage numbers, that team and attempt numbers. That team threw the ball the entire time he was there. And we asked Sean Payton once why they devoted so much money to Jarre Evans, who's not – he's not Quentin's level of guard, but he's real close. He was real close to it for a long time. Like he's going to be in the Hall of Fame discussion as a left guard and then a right guard for a while. And Payton's answer was basically, if we had the left tackle, we'd pay a left tackle. Like you just pay good linemen who block. Nelson has only given up 4 sacks in 4 years or something like that. Something incredibly minuscule. And it's honestly easier. I know you can double team. I know it's harder to get guys free on the inside. I understand all of that. But edge rushers, in terms of whether or not, like if you go up against an edge rusher who's really good, there are ways to sort of scheme around that with quick throws and stuff like that. It's a lot harder to do that when Aaron Donald's in there. It's a lot harder to do that when Buckner's in there, when Chris Jones is in there. When it's pressure up the middle, that's been the book on Brady for a long time, is if you can get to him up the middle where he can't step up into the pocket in front of the edge rush, and hit him and hit him over and over again from the middle, that's one of the ways to do it. It guards protect the quarterback too. And Quentin Nelson's done a very good job of it. And I just don't understand the idea that, like, so with running back and with guard and with some of the positions that I agree are not as valuable overall, the extension that people go is, well, then just don't try to have a good player at those positions. Like, don't care about it at all. Just no resources, no anything. But Quentin Nelson is very valuable to the Colts, both in the running game and the passing game. I understand that the running game is where, the Colts sort of give him agency to lead there, and it's the one that produces a lot of the highlights. But he's very, very good at pass blocking too, and that's important. It's important, especially when they are looking for the left tackle of the future and trying to see if they've found one with the two guys they have now.
Yeah, if you thought that they had issues at left tackle last year with Eric Fisher, imagine if they just had a replacement level guard for 17 games playing next to that. It would have been very glaring, and all of a sudden teams would have overloaded that side, and it would have become a problem. So I've looked at guard kind of like I look at running back, except it has a much longer shelf life, so that's different. But in terms of, like, there are more replacement level players at that position than most, but there still is that percentage of players that are irreplaceable, and Quentin Nelson's one and Jonathan Taylor's one. And it's the same deal where, like, there could have been a game or two last year if Jonathan Taylor missed and maybe Marlon Mack steps in and runs for 100 yards on a, subpar defense. And you could have made an argument of, like, why keep a running back? Why invest in a running back? And then it's like, well, by the end of the year, when teams are stacking the box and Taylor's finding a way and scratching out 100 yards, how many guys can do that? Very, very few. In fact, probably like two or three in the NFL. So, the fact that Nelson is, especially in this version of the Colts, where Matt Ryan can, he can slide protections, he can set protections, he can throw fairly quick, he can manage kind of like exterior pressure. He's had a hard time with interior pressure, which, quarterbacks who are not overly mobile are going to have. And if you don't think that an interior lineman matters, just go watch the Super Bowl and see how the Bengals try to handle the Rams. And I think you'll see that they absolutely have a important place when you can get it down pat.
Well, 2 years, and not just this Super Bowl, but if you look at the Chiefs-Niners Super Bowl a couple of years ago, Butner and Jones were honestly the two best players in that game. And came really, really close. I kind of thought Chris Jones maybe should have been the MVP of that game with how much he wrecked it. So, I understand that not all guards, they're not as valuable as tackles. I get that. But if you don't have the tackle, you need to have good, like, it matters to protect the quarterback. Protecting the quarterback leads to a good passing game. It just does.
Yep.
And so I know that there's been a little bit of talk about the Bengals and how they didn't have much investment in their offensive line, and they ended up in the Super Bowl this year. But I mean, that's also ultimately why they didn't win the Super Bowl.
And they went out this offseason and addressed that and spent not a ton of money, but more money than they ever normally do, because they know it's not sustainable long term. All you need is one injury to your quarterback, and you wish you had that pass protection. As Colts fans should really understand.
Moving on to Ryan, says, I feel like the John Fox hiring has flown under the radar. Could you expand more on that move and how it could help Bradley's defense evolve? Frank Reich was really interested in adding this to the defense, and said that, and basically it's to keep the defense evolving and expanding. So that you're not doing Reich is somebody who understands very well that there are ways to attack defenses when you see tendencies. He's good at it. It's one of the things he's good at. And so I think he's tried to push the defense over the last couple of years. Him and Ballard have both tried to push Eberflus's defense to be a little bit more multiple. I think their influence had something to do with the cover three and cover three match. So some of the more man that they were playing the last year or so. And Fox does that because he doesn't come from the same Seahawks tree. John Fox comes from a quarters tree, and it just the idea isn't to force Gus Bradley to do things he doesn't want to do. The idea is to understand Gus Bradley's defense and say, hey, what if we saw it from this way? What if we added this to it within your system? And that's what helps the defense stay ahead and make it harder on offenses to know what they're doing and exploit their coverages.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I haven't gotten to talk to I wasn't at the owners meetings to get that explanation. I did cover John Fox, my first job in this league, covering the Bears when he just got hired. I was just there for his very first year. And I remember he brought in Vic Fangio at the time, and they were trying to fix the worst defense in the NFL, essentially. It's maybe the worst defense in Bears history, if I remember. And I mean, they were pretty much, they're transitioning from 3-4 to 4-3, and they're just sort of dumping all these bodies and turning them over. And almost every single player, except I think Kyle Fuller, got flipped over in that process. But they did a nice job with it. They drafted and developed to it. They drafted Adrian Amos in like the fourth round. He ended up being a really good player, signed with the Packers. And they just kind of found a way to make it competent by making it just kind of giving it some legitimacy. So I think he's just another kind of veteran voice that's going to add to Gus Bradley to help do some of that. And I do think evolving and having slightly different ideas and approaches is important. And it was something that, to be frank, was a concern here last year down the stretch when the whole team fell apart those final two games, of course. But part of it was the defense that caught up to them. Some of the just the static plays and coverage. I know they were doing more man match, but they still were giving tons of free releases. They were playing more zone than I think that than they wanted to play at times. And so it kind of bit them at times in there. So actually, I should say, in fact, like sometimes they go too far the other direction. Once man match was working, they were running a lot of man down the stretch and it didn't work. I mean, all of a sudden you saw Kenny Moore go from a Pro Bowl player to a guy who was getting cooked in the slot sometimes when they didn't have the pass rush to help him out. Like they're just... Matt Eberflus did a really nice job here, and I'm not trying to take away from it, but one of the things was everything was like on his plate, and so that's going to naturally lead you to places that are a little more, you know, static and unchanging, as if you just have one person do what they've done forever, and that's kind of the only person really making those decisions, which Frank Reich has left the defense up to the coordinator. That's the kind of pitfall you have sometimes. So I think John Fox just is a small way to kind of guard against that.
Landon Oliver asks, do you think a veteran wide receiver is still in play? And if so, who would you think fills that role?
Yeah, we've touched on this a few times. It's kind of, I think the question I get the most is like, what the heck are they doing at the receiver room? They added Alec Pierce in the draft, obviously, but the youngest receiver room probably in the NFL, or at least among teams trying to contend. So I think the answer that we've often given here was T.Y. Hilton, because obviously he's made it known he'd like to come back. The Colts have been in talks with him. They have a role in the slot that he could play. But I'm not sure how to read that situation here, because he's still unsigned. And he knows what the market is for him and it's not for him. They know what they need. There is an opening there in the slot, potentially, as at least a number four player who could be a number three, you know, if and when Paris Campbell is unavailable. And it still hasn't happened yet. And they are so close and in communication that I wonder why it hasn't happened yet. So I don't know where that stands. I just the longer we go where it hasn't happened, I'm less confident that it's going to happen.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had it brought up to me by JMV on the radio that something about Julio Jones, I'm still not sure I really see that, just considering that Julio Jones is basically an outside receiver. I don't know. Plus, he's got maybe it's something that I'm not seeing with Jones, but like everything that Ballard's done in the past, like just the same issues with availability or that Jones has had are the one that's the biggest concern with Hilton. And I don't, for this team, if you're going to take a chance on somebody who might be hurt, I would want it to be somebody who brings leadership, who brings gravitas to the locker room, who adds something even when he's not on the field. Not saying that Julio Jones can't bring that, but T.Y. was the vocal head of the team last year, you know, in a lot of situations. We saw that on Hard Knocks. So that's kind of a weird thing. I think that they could definitely still add a veteran wide receiver. For me, it's kind of always been Hilton, but I'm like you. It should have happened by now.
Yeah, well, I will say with Julio Jones, the one, I think, argument for him over T.Y., if you were to go down that route, is that I think Julio can have an effect on the two outside receivers, Michael Pittman Jr. and Alec Pierce. Obviously, Hilton's had some effect on Pittman as well, but Julio's the one built like them. He's the guy who's 6'3", and when he was at his peak, I mean, that was the guy that every bigger receiver has ever wanted to be because he's this huge, you know, basketball player in the middle of who can cut in breaking routes in the middle of the field, and his change of direction are just outrageous for a player that size. And he just found a way to really run routes incredibly well for a guy who's, you know, you look at him and you think this guy's only going to try and win with size. He would win with speed and precision as well. And again, you add in his connection with Matt Ryan, there's a very clear path here, at least with Pittman, to try and build the next Julio Jones or something that's at least, you know, in that stratosphere. I know Pittman has talked about how he has modeled his game after Julio. So to have him in the building with Matt Ryan could be very valuable. To me, again, does Julio want that role? And that may be the holdup too. Because he's not a slot receiver, so it's less playing time to come in with those two starting on the outside. Does he want to just kind of be a more of a coach on the field who's a backup to those two? I don't know. And then, yeah, how many games do you get out of that? Is that worth filling the roster spot up if he's then going to be out for, you know, key stretches? Or maybe it keeps him healthier to not play as much. So I definitely think both of those are on the table. As you look through, they're the only ones that make a lot of sense for where they're at, because, like, I know they've been interested in Jarvis Landry. I just don't see them meeting the contract demands he has. At some point, Jarvis has got to drop that to some level because he's not getting signed. I saw he turned down a 1-year deal with the Browns. But at the same time, he wants to go to a place, especially if he's going to sign a 1-year deal, which I think teams want him to sign. He's going to want to go to a place where he can still produce and sign another good 1-year deal in a year from now. And this offense that just drafted a receiver has Pittman, has Hines, has Taylor, that's going to run the ball a lot. I don't know that that's the easiest spot for him, but it is a place he could come in, and I think he'd connect well with Matt Ryan and win here. So it's all about kind of who wants to give in here, because I don't think this situation it's clearly not perfect for either of these guys, or I think Hilton would already be here if it was. So one of them, I think, is going to have to give in somewhere, and I think at the end of the day that one of them will be in this building.
A couple more from Twitter. I'm going to try to go a little faster. Which past draftees do you see stepping up and making more of an impact with the team this year? This is from Craig Boone. He sees Will Fries having more of an impact. Quiddy Pay and Daiwo Dangbo. Is that a simple? It feels pretty obvious, but pass rushers tend to make a pretty decent jump in the second year. Odangbo doesn't have to deal, is coming, he's going to be a full year removed for the Achilles, which I've been told is when you really start to get your explosion back. And they've got more help. Yeah, the presence of Yannick Ngakoue just for Buckner is not just for Buckner. That also helps them. So that's the two that jump to mind immediately.
Yeah, I think those are the easiest answers. But to throw one out there that I think I don't think people are thinking enough about is Paris Campbell, because as we keep talking about, they still have not filled the slot. The slot's wide open. I don't think that's all by accident. I think they want to give him the chance if he's healthy. Of course, you can't count on it. He's only played 15 games, but as of right now, he's healthy. And if you look, the injuries have all been pretty fluky. They're not these things that are like, it's not like ACL tears and stuff that gets cumulative. I don't know that he's this broken down player at all. It's just he, you know, for whatever reason, when he's been out there, he keeps having these injuries pop up. But there's a lane where if he actually stays healthy, this is pretty perfect for him to step in as the slot receiver beneath those big trees on the outside and really build something with Matt Ryan, where Matt Ryan will know the situations that are advantageous to him and all of a sudden could build confidence for him, which I think that was a big problem the past couple of years. Do quarterbacks all the time. I don't know that they all worked. I'll say at least last year, I don't think built up younger receivers very well, that I think Matt Ryan can really use a guy to the best of his abilities. And I just think the fact that they haven't done anything at slot receiver still indicates to me that they have at least a hope for Paris. At least they want to give him the chance, not block him with a Jarvis Landry. And they at one point loved him enough to take him in the second round out of Ohio State, where he had, it was the first 1,000-yard receiver they had in almost 15 years.
Stevie R asks, over under 4 primetime games for the Colts and 2 at home when the schedule is released on Thursday. I'm taking the under because I don't trust the NFL to put the Colts in primetime.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's jokes that they don't get primetime games ever since Chuck Pagano called his famous fake punt. And it's like they can't put them on
national TV anymore. Put them on primetime. That's a reason to put them on primetime. No offense. I know this is a painful thing to discuss for Colts fans, but like, if that happens on and just a noon game when people are watching 8 other games at the same time, it's not as big a deal. And like the full, it would be in Indianapolis, but not the whole NFL. Just saying that would be a dumb reason for the NFL not to do it.
I agree, but I don't think the NFL has our same, I guess, sardonic humor. But yeah, I'm going the under too. It's also because, like, even as I think people within the league are realizing the Colts are, you know, becoming a pretty decent threat, but I just don't think nationally that's the vibe. They're still, I want to say their odds for the Super Bowl were like 20-1. Like, is they're going to be like a lot of places' favorite bet for like longer shot Super Bowl odds, because they're just not thought of in any way in the realm of other players. They don't have, you know, again, Matt Ryan is a big name from his career, but they don't have the young quarterbacks that excite everybody that you want to see in primetime, even though I think they'd be a good primetime team because there still are a lot of really good players and star players that I think general fans would love to see. And I think when they played on New England, I heard from a lot of fans around the league that they really enjoyed watching what the Colts had in that game. But I just don't think that they move the needle enough to, you know, nationally for people who are not Colts fans right now to do that.
Jonathan Taylor, I think, is the guy who could maybe change that equation a little bit. Just because, like, I remember watching the Lions in primetime a lot when I was a kid, and that was all about Barry Sanders. That had nothing to do with the Lions at all other than Barry Sanders. So I think Taylor becoming, you know, he was a unanimous, I almost said anonymous, that's ridiculous. He was a unanimous, you know, AP All-Pro guy last year. I think Taylor could maybe change that equation. My experience is that the NFL doesn't ever see the Colts as interesting as they probably should, and so they don't put them in prime time. It doesn't have – I've said this before. I don't understand the small market thing at all, because Green Bay is in a small market, number one, and they're on prime time every other week. I know they have Aaron Rodgers, whatever. But the other thing about it is – that where the game is played doesn't matter for TV. Just doesn't. You could play it on a high school field in Dayton, and it doesn't matter to the people on TV because they're just watching for the matchup. So that's a dumb argument to me.
Well, one thing I would do think that hurts them is the division they're in. Like, they don't have as many games that are exciting that have these divisional implications, that have two teams in it that can really move the needle. Whereas, like, especially in the AFC right now,
it's pretty much Colts Titans, and
right.
That's it.
And I don't think either of those teams are moving the needle nationally. I think the Titans have some of the same exact concerns, especially now that they moved AJ Brown. But like, you think about, like, in the AFC West, you're going to have Justin Herbert against Patrick Mahomes. That one's easy. You could have Derek Carr against Russell Wilson, and you know those two teams, and one that just moved to Vegas recently. Like, that's easy. You could have Bengals Ravens, a team that just went to the Super Bowl with a team that's always in the mix. Like, they're just in, and then, you know, you can go on in other conferences too. I guess the NFC does not have as many, but the NFC West does, like 49ers, Rams. Like, these two teams, I feel like both of these are Super Bowl contenders with like big time quarterbacks. I don't think the Colts have a matchup like that. Now, of course, they do. They play other games, but they don't have the one that's like, this will decide, you know, the AFC West you know, really put a team in position to make a run in the playoffs. So all these little factors pretty much add up to say I don't think they're going to get a lot of primetime games.
Which will make it easy on me because I will probably once again write that it's dumb.
We love 1 p.m. games, but I know fans don't care about our schedules, and nor should they. So for their sake,
it's become honestly the easiest column I write every year is the Colts didn't get any primetime games. They probably should have. And I get to kind of be angry. So I'll write it if they don't do it. If you see another one that we haven't asked, some of the other questions kind of touch on stuff we've already touched on, so I'm not going to repeat them. But
I guess
tall short, which is funny because of the question that he asked, says maybe tall short. I apologize if I mispronounced that. Why does Ballard prefer taller wide receivers? Feels like a smaller, shiftier slot option could open some quick hitters. I realize Hines and Paris will be used more in the slot, but I think it's a small piece still missing. I'll let you go, but I'm going to go find Chris Ballard's exact answer on this and read it after you're done.
Okay. Well, then I'll touch more on the missing piece element of it, because I agree with that. I think they actually, they might agree with that too. I know they were in free agency, at least looking into some guys who were not this taller catch radius type that they always go for. And I think the big reason is that Joel touched on with the quote is just like what they're willing to bank on in unproven commodities. They feel like the bigger catch radius will help younger receivers. It's all a dart throw in the draft. Whereas like if you're going in free agency, like to sign a guy like some of the established slot receivers we've seen out there, like a Cole Beasley or obviously Wes Welker when he was doing it, or Jarvis Landry or Golden Tate, like you don't have to, there's not much projection there. Use them exactly the way that they've been used in their previous teams, and they're going to get open and they're going to make plays. And I think that if they could find that type of player, that would have a huge, huge role in this, huge value to this offense. That's like where if Jarvis Landry was available at the right price, he could be a great addition to Matt Ryan to let you not put too much on Alec Pierce's plate, to work the middle of the field, to just get this guy who just finds a way to make consistent plays again and again and move the chains. Whereas like last year, I do think they missed that, is that everything with Carson Wentz and that offense was either a big play from Taylor, a big play from Pittman, or a punt, you know. And I know a lot of it's Carson didn't look in the middle of the field, but also, you know, they could also have better guys in the middle of the field, and they don't really have them now as far as guys who are going to actually stay healthy and be on the field. So I do think it's a missing element here.
Chris Ballard's exact answer to this question the night they drafted Alec Pierce was, I think for your quarterback, big targets, big catch ranges help him. Look, I'm not against guys that are smaller either. It just hasn't worked out that way. The guys we've identified and the spots we've been able to draft, they have just been bigger guys. I mean, the fact that they've drafted so many bigger guys says that they do value it more than others.
Yeah, well, and but also the first they, part took, of that, they took the Alec first Pierce part over that, Sky Moore, I'll just point out.
The first part of that answer is, I think, the more revealing part of why he likes it. He thinks the big catch radius helps receivers. Or helps quarterbacks, sorry.
Yeah, no doubt. But yeah, it's they always do prefer that over something that feels even more polished. Like to me, the Alec Pierce versus Sky Moore debate was kind of quintessential, because it's like Sky Moore is more polished. He has a much more diverse route tree. He's got more, you know, more production, and you could easily put him in. I bet you he's gonna have a much better statistical year with the Chiefs than Alec Pierce will with the Colts. But again, it's a different role too, what they want on the outside, how they want to attack teams and spread the field, and all for a Jonathan Taylor led offense. And then, the catch radius too. But I do think the blocking element's a little bit of this too, is that, you know, those shorter guys are, you know, more stressed to block effectively. And this is a team that does think about that when they've got Jonathan Taylor and they want to run as much as they do.
A couple other questions we got, Flirt Cobain, great name, by the way. Do you think that Nick Cross will take Kari Willis's spot on the roster as a starter? I'll go yes, but maybe not till next year, just because he's a rookie.
Yeah, I think there's no doubt that when they trade next year's a day two pick next year to move up into the third and take Nick Cross, like, they want him to be a starter. That's the plan. And it seems like a decently safe bet. He started 3 years at Maryland. Like, he just needs to be more in a defense where he's playing more in the box, closer to the line of scrimmage, and can just actually get to plays more, which, and when you project it out, for as much as I know they like Julian Blackman a lot, the one bigger opening is that other strong safety spot. And Kari Willis is in the last year of his deal. I wouldn't be surprised if it happened this year, though. Like, he's got a chance to really take over in training camp, in some of those practice settings, and really show that impact of that speed. He was the fastest safety at the NFL Combine. That's kind of where Kari Willis is, you know, not up to par the same way. He's not this kind of blowaway athlete, which is what they keep drafting nowadays. So if he looks like a guy who's a little more upside, especially as a cover guy, then I wouldn't be surprised if he finds his way in there. And also, it may happen because both safeties they have get hurt. And sometimes you have a situation where a guy gets hurt and then another guy comes in and he just plays so well. You're like, well, he's the starter now. So it's definitely going to happen. I think it may happen sooner than later.
Not DB Cooper asks, will the Colts bring someone to compete with Blankenship? The answer to that is yes. At least one is already here. His name is Jake Verity. He was Justin Tucker's understudy last year.
Well, they also invited with Grayson Atkins. Right to the
a couple others. There's a couple. I think there's going to be probably three or four kickers trying out at the rookie mini camp this weekend. So they might add another one if somebody has a good camp. Lucas Robbins says, which would you rather have, the Colts at Jags in week 18 again, or Jags at Colts but in London? Well, we know the international games, so they're not playing that this year. If it's me, I don't give up the home game.
Well, are we answering this for the Colts or for ourselves? Because I would love to go to London. I have never been to Europe. So I will take that personally. But yes, with you, I'm with you. Other than that, I would not give up the home game if I'm the Colts.
Yeah, no, so
I do understand why. Colts at Jags, like, you just know how it's going to play out. No matter how bad the Jags are, no matter how good the Colts look or how hot they are, like, there's just going to be such a nervous energy in it. We talked at one point, like, are curses real in sports? And I think the fact that we asked that question and debate it shows they kind of are. Like, there is something to when they go and play in Jacksonville, and the second that it starts snowballing, the memories of past collapses come back. So it wouldn't be fun to do that either.
I also don't want, I'm going to add to Lucas's question here. If I'm the Colts, I don't want to be the opener either, or really any of the first 3 weeks or so, just because I'm a big believer in the early season Florida humidity being an issue. Just because it's I know it's hot up here in Indy, but the humidity's not the same. And when you've done training camp up here the whole time, like, I really do believe that when you take a northern team and put them in the humidity early in the season, it is a difficulty for them.
Yeah, same way that, like, if a team in the South that plays outdoors, like Miami, has to go to, like, Buffalo in January and try to win a playoff game. Like, it's anytime you flip the elements, it's never fun. And of course, the Colts ran into that a couple years ago, week one in Jacksonville. It's the only win the Jaguars had all year was when they beat the Colts there. So it doesn't seem like it's ever a great time to play in Jacksonville for this team, but something about, like, the first or last week of the season just seems to bring even more scarring memories to the whole experience.
Okay, a couple of fun ones here at the end. From the Blue Stable, Michael Pavia says, why haven't I come back on their show? I have not been invited, Michael.
I've been on there twice.
Not that I'm aware of. I think Destin asked me a while back, but I was unable to do so because of family issues. But I don't think I have a standing invitation. I don't think I can just come on whenever. So that's the answer to that question.
Yeah, they're good dudes. I've been on with them twice. They've also jumped in some of the spaces I've held. But I guess they're feeling a little... They've probably had too much of me. They need to go back to the other side of the Indy Star.
Well, Destin has been on this podcast before, too, when Jim was out before at once. And then from Felipe Costa asked, why the horseshoe? I don't know how to answer that one.
Colts. I know the history
logo.
For that.
I will say this. I think it is a fantastic logo. I think it's a really, really good logo. I also like the bucking horse with the little helmet. The Colts have good logos, but the simplicity of the horseshoe as a logo is I think one of the better ones. It's got a real like classic vibe to it that I really like.
Yeah, also just Colts like that. Is there another team named the Colts in any high level of sports? I can't really think of one.
I'm not aware of them. Unique mascot is good.
Unique mascot. It doesn't have a chance to be changed. I don't think it's offensive to horses, but I don't know that for sure. It's a cool logo. It's interesting that I hear so many players say just like, you know, we're united by the horseshoe on our helmet. Like it's just a different, it's a little corny, but it's a little like, it just makes them different than saying, like, I don't know that how many NFL teams can just kind of identify by a unique logo with a unique mascot that way.
And then the one last question that we have in here, and this is tongue in cheek. I'm kind of being a little cheap here. Fletcher Hogue asked, what's the pod called? And that's a good place to wrap up. For Joel A. Erickson and Nate Atkins, this has been the Colts Cover 2 podcast, available now wherever you get your podcasts. The Colts Cover 2 podcast. We're here just about every week, although that's going to change a little bit in the summer when nothing's going on.